I'm Belinda McCauley, Executive Director of the Beverly Hills Bar Association and the Beverly Hills Bar Foundation. Today's program is presented by the Beverly Hills Bar Foundation, which is BHBA's charitable arm. As you saw when you registered, the program is free, but the foundation needs funds for programs like today's. Its free legal clinic that directs residents of Greater LA to legal aid resources, and its signature annual program, the Public Interest Scholarships Program. These annual scholarships, awarded for more than 50 years to students at five LA area law schools, support students who have committed to do public interest work, including in some of the spaces you'll hear discussed here today. We'd so appreciate your donation to support the foundation at bhbf.org. And now I'm delighted to introduce the moderator for today's panel, Stephen Rohde. Steve is a constitutional scholar, lecturer, writer, political activist, and retired civil rights lawyer. He's a past president of the Beverly Hills Bar Association, a founder and chair of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, past president of the ACLU of Southern California, a past chair of Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice, and is on the board of Death Penalty Focus. He's written extensively in media, including for the LA Times, Huffington Post, Truthout, American Prospect, and Ms. Magazine, and is a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Review of Books and Los Angeles Lawyer Magazine. Steve will introduce the panelists and then guide today's discussion. Steve, over to you.
Thank you very much, Belinda, and thanks everybody for joining us on a Monday morning for what I think and we think is a very important topic to address. You know, people are fond of lawyers' jokes and even comments like, first thing, let's kill all the lawyers. Well, that's often misquoted at cocktail parties. Shakespeare wrote it in Henry VI, Part II. But U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens understood why Shakespeare put those words in the mouth of the villainous character Dick the Butcher. Justice Stevens wrote, Shakespeare's insightfully realized that disposing of lawyers is a step in the direction of a totalitarian form of government. He understood that, and that is the backdrop for today's program. It is reported that 297 active cases are pending against President Donald Trump and the Trump administration. All of those cases were filed by lawyers and are being heard by judges who are grappling with the some of the most unprecedented and serious legal and constitutional issues of our history. It's reported that over 180 rulings have temporarily enjoined or stayed some of the Trump administration's actions. One source indicates that 67% of all federal injunctions in the last 100 years have been against the Trump administration. To address these issues, and there are so many, but today we are looking seriously at attacks on the rule of law, lawyers, and judges. We've really been able to assemble an extraordinary panel. I will briefly introduce them, but in your materials and online, their full bios are included. Patricia Corrales specializes in criminal defense and immigration law. She began as a deputy district attorney in Denver, Colorado. From 1995 to 2012, she was an attorney at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Department, ICE as we know it. She is familiar with the issues of immigration law on both sides of the subject. Our second panelist will be Barry McDonald. He has taught constitutional law, First Amendment law, and comparative constitutional law at Pepperdine School of Law since 2000. He graduated cum laude from Northwestern School of Law. He clerked for Chief Justice William Rehnquist, and he worked for the U.S. State Department, the law firm of Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher, and as general counsel for two tech companies. Judge Joe Hilberman served on the L.A. Superior Court from 2001 to 2009. He is now with ADR Services as an arbitrator and mediator. In 2008, and I've known Joe so long that my daughter babysitted for his kids, so I call him Joe with full and honorable respect. Joe was chosen in 2008 as Jurist of the Year by the LA chapter of the American Board of Trial Advocates. Before becoming a judge, he practiced law for 27 years, specializing in civil litigation and mediation. In 2022, he was a member of the Judicial Independence Committee of the American Board of Trial Advocates, which issued a revised version of a comprehensive report entitled Preserving a Fair, Impartial, and Independent Judiciary. A copy of that report is among the 174 pages of resource materials which all of us have assembled that is available to everyone who is attending and watching this program. I can't urge you enough after the program to go to those materials. Included is a sample of President Trump's executive order against law firms. There's a statement by the California State Bar on this issue. I have included an article on this subject. There's an amicus brief filed by former state and federal judges in support of a motion to dismiss the indictment against Wisconsin State Judge Hannah Dugan, which we'll be discussing today. There's a really important 102-page memo opinion dated May 2nd by Judge Beryl Howell in the Perkins Coie case, which we will be discussing. All of those materials are substantive in support of the issues that we can only briefly touch on today. I do want to thank Belinda McCauley, Jenna Klushnikov, Rin Santiago, all on the staff of the Beverly Hills Bar Association who put in such effort to organize programs like this. And I'd like to also thank Alexander Rufus Isaacs and Ken Petrulis, who played an instrumental role in organizing this program, both of whom are past presidents of the Beverly Hills Bar Association and the Beverly Hills Bar Foundation. I'm going to give a rather substantive opening, more than many moderators may, because I want to lay the groundwork for all of our speakers so that they can focus on their perspectives and their analysis of these important issues. We now know that 9 of America's largest and most powerful law firms have surrendered to Donald Trump's threats through executive orders and other policy issues. They have agreed to provide $940 million in free legal services to causes chosen by Donald Trump and the law firms, while also agreeing to discontinue their diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. Fortunately, several other firms have refused to abide by those orders and are fighting back. To date, 3 full-dress preliminary injunctions have been issued and 1 TRO in the latest case, which is still under consideration. I want to note that this began in February 25th when Donald Trump issued his first memorandum against Covington and Burling, suspending security clearances because they had advised special counsel Jack Smith. On April 9, emboldened by the law firms that had begun to cave in because previously Latham and Watkins had agreed along with other law firms to provide substantive benefits to the administration. On March 6, Trump issued another executive order suspending security clearances for the law firm of Perkins Coie, criticizing their diversity and inclusion policies. What's very important in this discussion is there's no concealing the stated purpose of these executive orders. President Trump explicitly cited Perkins Coie's representation of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton during her 2016 presidential race. Perkins Coie immediately hired the firm of Williams and Connerly, which filed suit, leading to the first of the rulings, which included a May 2nd preliminary injunction by Senior Judge Beryl Howell, which I've alluded to. On March 14, Trump issued an executive order against the New York firm of Paul Weiss. Here he attacked an attorney, Mark Pomerantz, who had left Paul Weiss to assist the Manhattan District Attorney in its probe of Trump's finances. When Pomerantz resigned, he issued a letter stating his belief that Trump was guilty of numerous felony violations. Just days later, in his first victory, Trump rescinded the executive order because Paul Weiss agreed to provide $40 million in pro bono work for causes the administration supports and the firm would end. On March 22nd, Trump named the Elias law firm. And the pattern is similar in terms of the statements made against Mark Elias, I should say, and his representation of Hillary Clinton. The pattern continued, and on March 25, the president issued an executive order revoking security clearances for Jenner and Block. Which immediately fought back. And on March 28, Judge John D. Bates of the U.S. District Court in Columbia issued a temporary restraining order. And subsequently on May 1st, a 52-page opinion granting a preliminary injunction. On March 27, Donald Trump issued an executive order against Wilmer Hale. He revoked their government contracts for engaging in, quote, partisan representation to achieve political ends and efforts to discriminate on the basis of race. That firm had employed Robert Mueller and other attorneys who worked with the Justice Department to investigate ties with Russia and the Trump campaign. That firm hired Paul Clement, a prominent conservative lawyer and former solicitor general. And on May 27, in a 73-page opinion, Richard Leon of the district court stayed Trump's order. On March 28, despite three injunctions having by then already been issued, Skadden Arps made a deal with Trump even before it was targeted by any executive order or by any memo from the White House, promising to provide $100 million in pro bono legal services. And finally, between April 1st and April 11, seven more law firms, Wilkie, Farr and Gallagher, Milbank, Cadwallader, Wickersham and Taft, Kirkland and Ellis, Allen, Overy, Sherman, Sterling, Simpson, Thatcher and Bartlett, and Latham and Watkins agreed collectively to provide $800 million in pro bono legal services. And finally, on April 9, emboldened by the firms that had caved in, Donald Trump issued an executive order claiming the law firm of Sussman Godfrey was weaponizing the legal system and engaging in dangerous efforts to undermine the U.S. Military. Sussman fought back and has so far, through the rulings of Judge Lauren Ali Khan, who granted a stay, a temporary restraining order on April 15, 2025. I've taken the time to recount those all in one place because it is near impossible for the public, let alone lawyers and judges, to keep track of this assault on lawyers and the court system. All of this has been accompanied by attacks on judges, calls for impeachment, and other efforts to undermine the rule of law. And that's exactly why we have convened this program today. We'll hear from each of our speakers. We'll engage in some interpanel conversation. And in the Q&A feature on your Zoom screen, you can put in a question, which, time permitting, we will address before the hour is up. I want to turn to Patricia Corrales to dig deeper into the court rulings, some of the analysis that judges have used to reach these conclusions, and also, time permitting, to talk about the response of the American Bar Association, the Beverly Hills Bar Association, law students, and including an LA Times ad that Patricia was instrumental in publishing, defending the rule of law. Thank you, Patricia.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you. Good morning to everyone at the Beverly Hills Bar Association, and thank you for having me. We are in this position because the government, the economy, and the politics of this country have not been healthy for a long, long time, and we all know that. And now we're facing a very critical time in our history as it relates to the rule of law. As Stephen pointed out, all those executive orders, one of the executive orders or directives that President Donald Trump issued was on March 22nd. And that one's a little different. While it does talk about a specific law firm, it also authorizes the Attorney General to go back 8 years and investigate immigration attorneys who may have filed documentation or filing or petitions in the federal court or any applications before any federal agency branch to determine if any of those filings were frivolous or fraudulent or in any way attacked President Trump's directives or executive orders. So when I read that March 22nd directive, I thought to myself, I cannot remain silent. I must not remain silent, because if we do remain silent, we are complicit in the attack against our democracy and against the rule of law. I love being a lawyer. It's something that I'm very passionate about. I never thought myself to be an immigration lawyer. That wasn't what my you know, thought process was when I was in law school. I thought I was going to be joining a big firm, but I ended up with the district attorney's office, and then lo and behold, I ended up with the agency. At the time, it was called INS, and now it's called the Department of Homeland Security. And people think of the Department of Homeland Security as ICE, but the Department of Homeland Security isn't just about ICE. It's about a bigger agency. It's an agency that determines prospective benefits for individuals who come to this country seeking hope, seeking a new life. And some of these individuals are well deserving of this new opportunity. And yet this executive order that the president issued on the 22nd has now taken such a toll on immigration lawyers because lawyers are afraid to file certain benefit applications because they're afraid of being investigated. What we're seeing on a day-to-day basis, and right now immigration is in the forefront of the news with the raids that are happening, the protests that are happening here in Los Angeles. And so I'm going to talk about that as it relates to that, because that's something I'm very familiar with, and it's very personal to me. When that directive came out, as I said and I mentioned, we could not remain silent. I had to gather and contact my colleagues, AILA, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, and ask them, we need to speak up. We need to say something. We cannot just let this go by and not say anything. And we can't be bullied by this president. We have to defend our clients. And I was astounded, to be honest, that there was so much reluctance by many of the lawyers, by many of my colleagues, because they were afraid. They were afraid that if they stood up, they were afraid if they spoke out, that this would affect their clients, that their clients would be targeted. And there was such a resistance. But luckily and fortunately, 30 brave lawyers, I gather, 30 brave lawyers to put together a defense to the attack on being an immigration lawyer, but on the rule of law in particular. And so, as Stephen mentioned, we published a op-ed that was openly published in the Los Angeles Times, and we got phenomenal response in relationship to that letter. And that letter is basically telling the president of the United States that he will not scare us, he will not bully us, that we have every right to defend those who are defenseless, those who have no voice. And I firmly believe that. And I firmly believe that these big firms, and I'm a small firm, these big firms should be taking the same stand. They should be able to stand up against this president and his administration and the tactics that this administration uses to defend those who are defenseless. Not just the big corporations, but those who are really defenseless. I recently was contacted by an attorney in one of these big firms who advised me that their firm can no longer do pro bono immigration work. And so they're referring out clients. To me, that's incredible. Big firms have the resources, the opportunities, or more opportunities to help those who are seeking asylum. If an individual has a unique asylum claim, big firms have those types of resources to get the investigators, to get the expert witnesses. And now big firms are not taking on these pro bono cases because they've made a promise. They've made an agreement with this administration to not handle any immigration cases. I find that to be outrageous. I find that to be outrageous, but I also find it to be a lack of strength. And we need to not be weak in this moment. I want to talk specifically about what we've seen since the executive order on March 22nd. We have seen lawyers like myself being prevented from representing our clients in immigration court. For example, during this particular protest this over the weekend, two of my clients were detained. I was prohibited from speaking to my clients. Now, the reason I was given was because it was too dangerous and the situation did not allow for me to talk to my clients. But a lawyer should never be prohibited from talking to their client. And an individual seeking representation should never be prohibited from seeking the assistance of a lawyer. And all the individuals detained over the weekend were prohibited from seeing a lawyer. Lawyers were, and I'm not exaggerating, were pushed, were prevented from talking to their clients, telephonically. We were given wrong numbers to contact. We were giving the false fax numbers to fax our notice of entry of appearance. Those are the types of tactics that unfortunately we are seeing on a day-to-day basis. And that's an attack on the legal system. If we allow that, the fundamental principles of our democracy are just going to, they're just going to go away. And we cannot allow that. We're also seeing on a day-to-day basis, government lawyers, and not all government lawyers, some are courageous, but many are in a very difficult position. They have homes, they have families to feed, and they need the job. But we have government lawyers that are espousing legal arguments. They're not sustained by law, if that makes any sense. They're making up legal arguments that have no basis or no merit in the law. And that's outrageous, because as a lawyer, we have a duty to be ethical before the court. And yet Department of Justice lawyers are being told that they have to make certain arguments before the court that have no basis, factual or legal precedent. And I find that just absurd and a violation of our ethical obligations. And we're pushing back. Us lawyers are pushing back. We're filing lawsuits against the administration for the denial of due process, the denial of access to our clients, the denial of benefits to our clients when clearly the individual was eligible for that benefit. And in doing so, what we're seeing, and is not an exaggeration, is I filed a federal lawsuit against the Trump administration. And 2 days after I filed the lawsuit, 4 ICE agents raided my client's house and detained him. Why? And I solely believe it's because I filed a lawsuit claiming that the government was acting without cause in denying my client's naturalization application. So these are the types of scare tactics, the type of bullying tactics that we're seeing. They're investigating immigration lawyers that are filing certain applications. They're investigating attorneys who file H-1Bs or VAWA applications. So lawyers are in my field are being careful. They're being hesitant to represent individuals. And that clearly has a negative effect in our rule of law, because we can't be afraid to represent our clients. So this is what we're seeing as a consequence of the executive order that Trump issued on the 22nd, because many of us are also getting emails from the court saying, back up your legal argument that you made on such and such a day. And I haven't received that, thank God. I haven't received one of those emails, but I know a colleague of mine that did receive that. And I know that Department of Justice lawyers are also receiving those sort of emails. Why? Because there is a sense of Department of Justice lawyers are being supervised in such a manner that they are espousing legal arguments that just have no foundation in both truth and law. And that, to me, is, I've never seen that before. And when I get a brief from the government attorney that has arguments that have no basis in the law, I'm flummoxed. I'm like, how is that possible? And so you respond in kind. And we're also seeing on a practical level, judges, immigration judges, they're not Article III judges, they're administrative law judges, but they are judges nonetheless. They have to be neutral. They have to be fact finders. They have to make decisions. And we're seeing judges afraid to make decisions, afraid to take the right course of action because of what it could do to them, because these judges are under a quota. And that to me is outrageous, for a judge to be pressured in that matter, because then the judge isn't free to act neutrally, the judge isn't free to act, you know, without bias. And so these are the kinds of day-to-day issues that we're facing as a result of this executive order. So it's not just affecting big law, it's affecting lawyers like myself, smaller firms.
Thank you, Patricia. I'm so grateful that you have put this in a real life context, the lawyers and the clients and the judges that are being affected by this. The order that Patricia highlighted, the March 22nd order, is in the materials that I referred to before, and I'm glad she gave it that broader context of the threat to go back and file Rule 11 and other motions alleging frivolous proceedings. I want to turn to Barry McDonald to give us even a deeper sense of what's at stake here. What are the principles of due process, of independent decision makers, and the kinds of vigorous advocacy that the American people really expect from their lawyers? We know that these decisions have called what, and these are the court decisions themselves, pernicious, unprecedented, cringeworthy, egregious, and shocking. Barry, take a few minutes to expand on those issues and give us your perspective.
First of all, I'd like to say thanks to Steve and Belinda for putting this panel together and inviting me to speak. As a professor of constitutional law, I told Steve that I thought my 10 minutes might best be spent focusing on the merits of the constitutional claims that are being litigated in these law firm cases. But having now had a chance to review the district court decisions, I've changed my mind. Why? Because the retaliatory actions being taken by the Trump administration against these firms seem so patently unconstitutional that they hardly seem to warrant serious analysis. For starters, it's textbook law under our system, as affirmed by the Supreme Court in the seminal Youngstown Sheet and Tube decision, that the executive can only exercise power as authorized by Congress or the Constitution. In other words, the executive is under law like every other citizen. And while Congress may have given the executive power to control certain issues with respect to government security clearances, government contracting, and the like, it's still black letter law that such power can be cannot be exercised in violation of the Constitution. A prime example of this is the Hamdi decision arising out of the September 11 attacks, where the Supreme Court held that while even though President Bush had been authorized by Congress to detain suspected enemy combatants, he still acted unlawfully in not respecting their due process rights. And in this case, there is little question that the Trump administration has violated the First Amendment by retaliating against these firms for advocating on behalf of clients or causes viewed as being opposed to Trump's personal or political interests. It is plainly a form of viewpoint discrimination, which is at the core of what the First Amendment prohibits, as well as a violation of rights of political association and related rights. In addition, the Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights to effective counsel of the law firm's clients seem clearly violated by these attempts to quell the vigorous advocacy of their causes. And as District Court Judge Richard Leon recently ruled, Trump also seems to be plainly violating the separation of powers by attempting to regulate the behavior of attorneys in cases before the courts, something that clearly lies within the responsibility of the judiciary itself. Perhaps the clear illegality of these executive orders is why the Trump administration has remained silent about appealing these rulings, something that is in stark contrast to what it usually does when it loses these types of cases. So let me instead spend the rest of my time making some broader points about the subject of this event. It might seem strange to talk about preserving the independence of the legal bar, professionals trained to be anything but independent and impartial in vigorously advocating for causes on behalf of clients. But here, we're not talking about the bar's independence from clients or even from courts and codes of professional conduct in order to make whatever claims an attorney wants to. After all, deeply rooted in our history and tradition is the principle that attorneys are officers of the court, having duties to serve not only clients, but also the broader interests of justice. Rather, we're talking about an attorney's independence from the political branches of government in making decisions about who to represent and how best to do that. Without such independence, our historic adversarial system of justice, where courts rely on the robust advocacy of both sides of a legal question to reach its own independent decision about it, would cease to function properly. And particularly in cases involving the government as one of the parties to the dispute. The Supreme Court made this point explicitly in the Legal Services versus Velasquez case, where it ruled that Congress violated the First Amendment rights of attorneys in conditioning the receipt of government funds on refraining from making certain claims and arguments about welfare laws. As the majority wrote in that case, an informed independent judiciary presumes an informed independent bar. And this is not just pie in the sky idealism. It is how our system is designed to enforce the rule of law instead of the rule of particular politicians. In other words, independent courts, supported by an independent bar, provide the foundation for even-handedly enforcing the rules we ourselves have made via our political representatives. In short, those rules and their impartial enforcement through our adversarial system is the cornerstone of American democracy and what separates us from a more autocratic form of government. And it takes little discernment to realize that in these law firm cases, the political interference seems much more pernicious and harmful to the rule of law than the Velasquez situation of Congress denying funds in connection with welfare cases. Here we have a president attempting to exact retribution for personal grievances arising from prior effects to have courts adjudge whether he violated the law in various cases. The most serious situation in my mind involves the Trump administration's actions against Covington and Burling for providing legal support to the independent counsel investigating the January 6 events at the Capitol. So here we have a then former president being forced to stand trial for a purported crime of historic proportions, an alleged attempt to hijack a presidential election based on claims of voter fraud uniformly rejected by the courts, who is only spared those proceedings by winning a relatively close second election. And then the Trump administration not only goes after Covington, but also many career government attorneys and law enforcement officers who were just doing their jobs to investigate the matter, accusing them of weaponizing the law, a claim that seems exceedingly perverse and disingenuous in light of how the Trump administration is reacting in these cases. I can't say I know for sure why Covington and other firms like Paul Weiss appear to have capitulated to these efforts, but many kudos to Perkins Coie and the other firms that decided to fight this out in court. And many kudos as well to Williams and Connolly and other firms who were willing to risk similar retribution for representing these firms. For in the end, confronting this assault on the independence of the legal bar can only effectively be done by appealing to the courts who, in turn, rely on the bar's work to function properly. And as Steve noted, as Shakespeare recognized, we need the courts to protect this aspect of the rule of law, since it's not likely to be the public's enthusiastic support for lawyers that does it. Which brings me to confronting the Trump administration attacks on courts that rule against them. As I've said, an impartial and independent judiciary is critical to the rule of law. That is why the founders created Article III courts with protections, such as lifetime tenure and compensation guarantees. Even though I'll be the first to admit the courts sometimes abuse these protections to impose their own political preferences on Americans. But that's a subject for another time. But once courts start deciding who wins cases based on the wishes of a political leader, now we're definitely moving from the rule of law to the rule of an autocrat. That is why Trump's attacks on judges who rule against him are so concerning. Many judges are being subjected to death threats after such attacks. And in the past, some judges and their families have been the target of deadly violence. Lately, judges have begun receiving pizza deliveries at their homes in the name of a judge's son who was killed by an extremist a few years ago. Thinly veiled threats telling judges that we know where you live. And you know we've reached a sad point when a conference of federal judges recently discussed creating their own personal security force because they can't be sure that the U.S. Marshals Service, which is under the executive branch, can be fully relied on to do the right thing if judges have ruled against the administration. This is a sad state of affairs and must be addressed to protect our democratic system of government. But how to confront this threat is a stickier problem than the threat to the bar. At least courts exist to protect that bar. But who will protect the courts if the executive and loyalist congressional leaders are reviling them for their rulings? Hopefully, if things remain at the level of ludicrous threats of impeachment or light criticisms, our courts will be able to weather this storm. So far, President Trump has said his administration will comply with court orders, although this pledge is being sorely tested in certain immigration cases. But if we reach the court where the Trump administration is openly defying court orders on a more serious scale, now we will have a constitutional crisis on our hands. It has been suggested that President Trump would never let it come to this due to the chaos such a situation would inflict on our financial and other markets, much more so than the tariff situation is currently causing. Well, I for one hope this is right, because I'd hate to think that Ben Franklin might have been onto something when he suggested to an inquirer outside the Constitutional Convention that the republic the founders gave us might not be easy to keep, particularly in an age when a large portion of our citizenry does not seem sufficiently engaged to recognize and respond to serious threats to our democratic form of government. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry. Just an extraordinary and tight examination of the issues that we're confronting. I'm very, very grateful to you for that. Now let's take a view from the bench. We were very grateful that Judge Hilberman joined us for this panel because there is the separate attacks on the judiciary that have been taking place. And I, for one, was impressed by the report that the American Board of Trial Advocates put out, preserving the fair, impartial, and independent judiciary that Joe had a hand in. Please give us your thoughts from the perspective of a judge and the perspective of how you resist outside influences and how you maintain judicial independence.
Thank you, Stephen, and thank you to the Beverly Hills Bar Association for inviting me to participate. I'd like to point out that these are my opinions, not the opinions of the court nor of ADR services with whom I currently work. One of the beauties of being the person who goes last on a panel is pretty much everything I wanted to say has been covered by everyone else. I did, however, wear my Supreme Court tie. I purchased this when I was visiting the Supreme Court, and they have a comment here, a number of things. Habeas corpus, for example, I'm going to find out from Christy Noem what that means when I have an opportunity to tell. You know, John Adams in 1780, in the Declaration of Rights and the Massachusetts Constitution, established the principle of judicial independence. And our Constitution created three equal branches of government: the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary. To ensure that independence, federal judges are appointed for life, so they don't have to be responsive to public whim or to political power or pressures, although it seems as though that is a diminished philosophy among some folks. Although this was established by Alexander Hamilton in Federalist Paper number 78. Judges are accountable to the Constitution. They're not accountable to politicians or to the public. They're accountable to the Constitution. Now, that's true, of course, as we know, with the federal judiciary. Here in California and in many other states, judges are elected. I, for example, was nominated and appointed to the bench by the governor at that time, Gray Davis, and then stood for election, as we're required to do in California, at the next general election. And I was then elected to a full term on the court. They can only be removed for violation or creation of high crimes and misdemeanors. And Justice Chief Justice Roberts brought that to everyone's attention when he commented on President Trump's comment that a certain judge should be impeached. And Justice Roberts correctly pointed out that the constitutional standard is impeachment is based upon the commission of a high crime or misdemeanor, not based upon an opinion with which the president disagrees. Members of the Congress picked up on that, and there were drumbeats to impeach certain judges. Never an action filed, as far as I'm concerned. My constitutional colleagues can address that more accurately, but I don't believe any articles of impeachment has ever been brought against any of the judges who've entered orders in these cases. We've had recall elections in certain jurisdictions based upon disagreements with the order of the court, the finding of the court, not the propriety of the finding, but rather just a disagreement in principle with what the judge ruled, rather than an argument about violating established law. The Annenberg School of Public Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, and I think this goes to Professor McDonald's point, they provided a survey in 2018. And at that time, they found that 21% of those surveyed indicated that if the Supreme Court started making rulings that most Americans disagree with, then they should just disband the Supreme Court. 21% of those surveyed adopted that policy. I was also taken by the executive memo that was part of your materials, and I just wanted to refer to some of these because this was a directive from the president, president's office, to the Attorney General and the Secretary of Homeland Security, which made reference to misconduct by lawyers and law firms that threaten our national security, homeland security, public safety, and election integrity. And as my colleagues have pointed out, there's no suggestion that any of those things were undertaken. It was rather just a disagreement. The memo goes on to state that the immigration bar, that's you, Patricia, the immigration bar, and powerful big law pro bono practices frequently coach clients to conceal their past or lie about their circumstances when asserting asylum claims, all in an attempt to circumvent immigration policies enacted to protect our national security and deceive the immigration authorities. There are no citations of authority to support that position in this memorandum. It goes on to say that under the federal rules, a lawyer shall not bring or defend a proceeding or assert or controvert an issue therein unless there's a basis in law and fact for doing so, and it should not be frivolous, and there have to be good faith arguments. Once again, no indication of when this has happened in any proceeding. And finally, it goes on to state, unfortunately, this is a quote, unfortunately, far too many attorneys and law firms have long ignored these requirements when litigating against the federal government or pursuing baseless partisan attacks. Now, we've all talked about this morning. We've talked about certain law firms that have acquiesced in President Trump's contention that they have crossed the line, and they've given millions and millions of dollars to Trump and his chosen charities, or whatever he's going to refer to them as, in order to continue doing business with the United States government, even though every court that's ruled on this has found that this order, this memorandum, was unconstitutional. I signed on to a number of these amicus briefs, and it's clear that these orders were just because of a dislike for the attorneys and the clients that they represented, not based on the law. There have been, and has been referred to, several assaults on the judiciary, both physically and intellectually. Justice Sotomayor recently referred to the relentless attacks disregard and disparagement of judges on a daily basis in the media and by elected officials. As I mentioned, there's a suggestion that some in the executive and the legislature that they can eliminate the court system by simply defunding it. There was a suggestion that we simply defund the Ninth Circuit and then we wouldn't have to deal with this anymore. Mm-hmm. We've read about threats to judges. Justice Kavanaugh had an armed person outside of his home who was apprehended. The professor made reference to the pizza delivery thing, which is really a way of telling the judge, we know where you live. And that's very intimidating. There's the image of the judge being perp walked because she purportedly assisted in one of the parties before her in exiting the court through another exit rather than the public exit of the courthouse. And instead of simply citing her for some violation, they arrested her and had her do the perp walk in front of the media, which was completely unnecessary and another assault on the independence of the judiciary through intimidation. There was a special report that published by Reuters in May of this year that highlighted a troubling surge in threats against judges and their families. They analyzed 600 social media and message board posts since February targeting the families of federal judges who had ruled against the Trump administration. Prominent Trump allies have amplified these by republishing and rebroadcasting, reposting, something I don't do, and I don't know how many of you do, reposting these things over 200 million times.
Oh my God.
The United States Marshals Service has documented 373 substantiated threats against federal judges in the first 5 months of this year. In 2024, there was a total of 500 such threats in the entire year, and there have been 373 through the first 5 months of the year. I recently had a conversation with some of my former colleagues, both on the California Court of Appeal and on the Superior Court, and significantly, they, although they have been trained in what to do in either a hostage situation or if there's an assault on the court or the courtroom, there have been no reported cases of physical assaults or threats directly at Superior Court judges in California or the Court of Appeal that these judges and justices with whom I spoke were aware. So what can we do as lawyers and as judges about the assault on the judiciary? Years ago, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor made the comment that there was a tremendous decline in civic education and that people didn't appreciate the three branches of government. And now we see this decline in civic education going further to the removal of books from our libraries to limit the amount of information, the breadth of knowledge that students and others who utilize the library, even the Library of Congress or the library at the Military Academy, can put out for their consumption of the patrons. 32%, and this is a recent study, this really disturbed me, judges worry about this. 32% of Americans were able to name all three branches of government, and 33% could not name the court as one of the three branches of government. Judges think we're pretty important. And when we find out that 33% of the surveyed public doesn't know about us, it's a little disappointed. So you as attorneys can be very influential in educating those with whom you interact on the basics of the Constitution. That includes speaking in schools, in civic meetings, with which you're engaged, and supporting organizations like the Bar Association or BOTA, which encourage the knowledge and understanding of the Constitution and the judicial system. For those of you who aren't litigators, you probably don't know about BOTA, which stands for the American Board of Trial Advocates. It has three basic principles. One, respect for the judiciary, civility in the practice of law, and the preservation of the right to a civil jury trial. Those are all fundamental to the institutions of justice. Recently, and I believe this was alluded to, Chief Justice Dolly G was addressing a group of federal judges and noted what she called a full body challenge to our constitutional order. And she also noted that silence of the bar is acquiescence. And I think all of us agree that we cannot be acquiescent in the attack on the Constitution and the judiciary. So the Committee for Judicial Responsibility here in California has proposed some new rules, which I believe are in the materials as well. But I wanted to address one other thing about people leaving the public service, as some judges have done under pressure. Recently, you may have read about a case in the federal court here in Los Angeles where a hard-fought conviction of felony was found against a police officer. Then a new U.S. attorney came into town and reduced the felony conviction to a misdemeanor. My friend was one of the attorneys who prosecuted that case, and he felt he could no longer be a member of the Assistant U.S. Attorney's Office and has resigned. He's a brilliant lawyer and a terrifically nice person of great moral character. So I suggested to him that he might consider applying for a position on the bench. And he told me that he was concerned about the safety of his family if he took a judicial appointment. And it just troubles me so much to think that we have declined into a position where lawyers and judges are afraid to take appropriate moral and ethical positions. So with that, I want to remind you that it's your responsibility to stand up for the judiciary, stand up for the rule of law. And one last thing I'll mention, and it was mentioned earlier today, and it's in an article in the Los Angeles Times today, quoting Professor Erwin Chemerinsky, who's a pretty good constitutional scholar like our two other panelists members here. And he said that the things that are going on now, particularly in California with the calling out of the troops, creates a chilling effect. And I know, Patricia, this has to do with your practice as well, a chilling effect on lawyers and their clients in expressing their rights. And I will personalize that because I was asked, along with 350 other retired judges and justices, to join as an amicus on the briefs that have been referred to. And I actually thought about it for a minute before I signed on. The fact that I had to think about it for a minute, I think, is a clear example of the chilling effect. So go forth and do justice.
Thank you, Joe. I think this may be part one of this discussion because we are verging on running out of time. There are questions in the chat. I want to frame two quick questions and quick answers from you. Barry, it is asked in the chat what you expect from the current U.S. Supreme Court in response to these rulings if they are appealed by the Trump administration.
Well, I suspect the Supreme Court will uphold what the district courts have done. I don't see an alternative course for them. But in terms of the broader array of emergency orders that are coming to the Supreme Court regarding district court and appellate court decisions respecting the Trump administration, I think the Supreme Court is engaged in a real delicate balancing act. It wants to enforce the rule of law, but at the same time, it does not want to provoke a serious constitutional crisis where it's being defied by the Trump administration. So I think it's going to be really interesting what happens in the future.
I did want to disappoint my friend Joe Hilberman. Six impeachment articles have been filed against federal judges already in the House of Representatives. Those are pending. When you read about them, they are directly focused on the substance of the rulings of these judges in violation of what Chief Justice Roberts spoke about and what you spoke about as well, Joe. Patricia, in addition to everything that has been said, is there a role to be played by the public? We are being watched by an extraordinary number of people today in this webinar, as well as those who will see it. And I am proud of the Beverly Hills Bar because, as Joe said, people are silent, and silence it betokens support for what is for the status quo and what this government is doing. So it's important that a bar association would hold a program like this. It's important that bar associations are speaking out on this. But as we direct this program to lawyers and others, what can the public do in the face of this, and why should this matter to the public?
It should matter to the public because this isn't just an immigration issue. I think what we're hearing a lot about is the immigration situation and how many of these executive orders target the immigration aspect of our laws. But this is not solely an immigration issue. This is truly a quintessential issue of the rule of law. We depend on these three branches of government for them to do their job independent of each other. And if one particular branch of that government, the executive, begins to order the other branches to do what that executive wants, then we have no democracy. And I think as individuals, as lawyers, as judges, as just folks, the citizenry, yes, learn about our civics, but speak out. And speaking out doesn't mean you have to throw mocktails or set cars on fire. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about write your congressman. If your congressman isn't doing his job or her job, then see if you can flip that seat. I mean, our congressmen have to respond to us. We are the people. That is what the Constitution says. We the people, not we the executive, not we the Congress, we the people. And if our leaders and our elected leaders are not holding the executive accountable, and to be frank with you, I'm just astounded at the lack of, I'm astounded at the silence from the, our other than AOC, you know, or others, you don't see a lot of Democrats holding town halls, Democratic congressmen holding town halls. We've got to hold our representatives accountable. And that's just my strong belief. The other thing I want to say, I want to touch upon is many of you may or may not know that on June 5th, because of all the ridiculous grounds of ridiculous legal arguments that are being made in some of these cases, there was an ethical complaint filed against the Attorney General in the state of Florida with the bar. It is important for all the bars to talk about this subject, but it's also important for us to not allow these arguments that have no foundation in fact, no foundation in law to perpetuate. We have to hold these lawyers accountable. And filing a complaint against the Attorney General, while that might sound, you know, unprecedented and a little bit, you know, frightening because how is it going to affect me? We can't think about it as how is this going to affect me? We are part of this country. We have to stand up for the principles and the foundations of this great country. So to be frank with you, I'm not afraid to stand up, but there are others who are afraid, and I can appreciate that. I truly can. But I don't think we can remain silent. We become complicit. And so I ask everyone to talk about it, to hold your representatives accountable, to speak up when you can.
Thank you, Patricia. And I'm sure you speak for all of us. The quote from Benjamin Franklin that was requested in the chat, a woman did approach him in 1787 outside the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia and asked, what have you accomplished? What form of government have you created? He responded, a republic, if you can keep it. If you can keep it. And he was talking to a prominent woman, not a member of the elected delegates. So this question that we leave you with is, can you keep it? On June 14, there are going to be nationwide No Kings rallies. It's estimated that 1,600 rallies are planned across the United States on that Saturday, June 14. That's what it means to keep it. It means to support those kinds of peaceful demonstrations. It means to speak to your congresspersons, to come out to those town halls, to write letters to the editor, to contact, and also to speak frankly over the dining room table with your family and your friends, to not allow a passing remark like kill all the lawyers to go by without addressing what's really behind that and the role that lawyers and judges play in our democratic system. That's what this panel's been about. We look forward to your comments to the Bar Association and others. We're going to spread this recording free, and you'll all get links. Please do consult the 174 pages of materials. They are accessible, they are readable, they are part of the civic education that Judge Hilberman spoke of, which this program today is an attempt to advance. Thank you for attending this. Thank you for doing something today for our republic and our constitutional democracy. Thank you very much.
You may be eligible for CLE credit in your state. Visit bhba.org/podcasts for more information.